We have this distinguished panel, and it's a participatory panel in the sense that this is the original cast. The original cast is not in the movie, and it's not in the book. The original cast is right here. So let's have a word of introduction from each member of the panel. Who are you?
I'm Jerry Fasher. I'm senior partner at Hale & Dorr. I've taught here the last 29 years. I was counsel for Beatrice Foods.
I'm Bill Cheeseman or Chessman or something like that. And, I'm with Foley, Hoag & Elliott, and I represented Grace, particularly focusing on the pretrial period.
My name is Michael Keating. I'm also at Foley, Hoag & Elliott, and I was the lead trial counsel for Grace in the case.
I'm Jonathan Hart. I wrote the book of civil action. I spent about 9 years of my life, and now, considering the additional 3 years, 12 years of my life on this case.
Can I stop you for a moment? We're all slaves of technology. Technology insists that you all take your badges off.
Oh.
You look better. Now, if you want the truth, we're making you take your badges off because your badges reflect into the camera's eye. We'd rather see you than the reflection of your badge. All right, back to the substance. Harriet?
My name is Harriet Clark, and I was one of the original jurors. I'm Donna Robbins. I'm one of the plaintiffs.
I'm Ian Anderson, as Dr. Laura would say, I'm Jimmy's mother.
I'm Mary Tomey. I've lived in Woburn from 1963 to the present, and my son, who died from leukemia, was Patrick Tomey.
I'm Dan Kennedy. I covered the trial and the appeals process for the Daily Times Chronicle of Woburn, and I have continued to write about the case from time to time for the Boston Phoenix.
My name is Kevin Conway, and I, along with Bill Crowley and Jan Schlickman, represented the plaintiffs in the Woburn case.
I'm Jan Schlickman.
Plaintiffs, defense, the journalists, and the actual litigants and the juror. Now, Jerry, in one of your interviews, you made an interesting observation that what we have in terms of Woburn is a magnificent example of 4 degrees of separation. And by that, I gather you meant, look, we've got reality. We've got reality, the truth. Who knows whether we've ever seen the truth? Then we've got the trial. Then we've got Jonathan's book. And now we've got the motion picture. And in a sense, the truth is separated through these degrees from the motion picture. So let's start this discussion by focusing on what you people believe is reality versus either what Jonathan wrote or what appears in the motion picture. Now, for that, I'm going to turn to Dan to start us off. Your sort of the most impartial person on this panel. You're a non-participant, and you've seen all of these degrees of separation. What's real, what's imaginary in your book, Ben?
Well, I think the way I would respond to that is that anyone who reads Jonathan's book is going to get a very accurate and real picture of the legal aspect of this story. But what I think has been lost is that the legal case was really a part of a much larger story, one that really goes back to the 1960s when the city of Woburn made that tragic decision to turn on 2 drinking water wells, even though they had more than enough information to know that they should never do such a thing. It's a story of citizen activists such as Ann Anderson and Donna Robbins and Mary Toomey and the Reverend Bruce Young, who knew that Woburn had a problem with childhood leukemia and demanded answers. And it's a story of government officials, some of whom fought these activists every step of the way, some of whom cooperated and ultimately began to find out the truth of what had happened in Woburn. And after that, I think the story is the story that Jonathan Haar has told in such an impressive way in his book. But I just think it's kind of unfortunate that the larger story has kind of gotten diminished, whereas the legal aspect of it has been elevated as if that were really the only important thing that happened.
And you didn't say a word about the movie.
Well, the movie is, I saw the movie, I liked the movie. I just put it in a very different category from anything else we're talking about here. It's rather heavily fictionalized. It's designed to be, I guess the best way to put it is, it's designed to be socially conscious entertainment, which is fine. And I think people will come away with some important messages about corporate irresponsibility and the consequences thereof, but I don't really consider the movie to be part of the reality picture at all.
Do you consider the movie inaccurate?
Oh, sure.
It's fictionalized.
Sure. There are some real psychic and emotional truths to the movie, but there are some glaring inaccuracies as well. Some of my complaints would be rather niggling, and it's simply because, well, I know what happened, and that isn't what happened. But the one thing about the movie that really kind of bothers me, that I think people will come away from, is the idea that government agencies didn't care until Jan Schlickman brought this case to trial. In fact, the Environmental Protection Agency and state agencies were there right from the beginning, and occasionally they were resistant at first, but I think that after a few years they were doing some very, very good work in Woburn long before the lawsuit really got going. And I think that's important, because I think it's important to note that the message that people will come away from, the government agencies were totally unresponsive to the citizens, is a message that plays very well into our psyche and into our belief about unresponsive government, and it's not true, and I think that's too bad.
Okay. Now, Jonathan, I can't refrain from asking the book writer as to the accuracy of the movie compared to the book.
Well, to go back to...
And I trust you've been fully paid at this point.
I've also become friends with the guy who wrote the screenplay, Steve Zalian, and who also directed it. Going back to the opening thing you said to Jerry, you quoted Jerry, who actually made that statement to me, the 4 degrees separation of reality, and he made it on the movie set. Words are imperfect mirrors of reality. What happens in a trial that takes 6 months is a very imperfect mirror of an event that had occurred over a period of a decade or two. And the movie, which is compressed into 2 hours, a compression of my 500-page book, a compression of the 6-month trial, a compression of the event that took 2 decades, becomes more imperfect. I think that these degrees of separation happen. The problem with any narrative, though, is that you have to choose a path. When you confront an event in which a lot of people are involved, you have to find a path, a way of assembling that event in a coherent way, and to tell the story, to communicate it to other people. And the minute you begin doing that, the minute you begin assembling the event, the minute the author does that, or the movie maker does that, you begin diverging from other people's version of reality. This is the writer's version of what he saw. This is the movie maker's version of his 2-hour version of the event. In the trial, it's competing narratives as well. The plaintiffs had one narrative and the defendants had another narrative, and each was competing for the jury's competition. How do you begin reassembling the real event? I think there is almost no way, except if you have many ways.
Jonathan, is that a subtle way of acknowledging you had a point of view in the book?
I tried very hard. I'm not in the book in the first person. What I did have was access, enormous access to the plaintiff's case that Jan and Kevin and Bill and the Woburn families, the eight Woburn families, granted me. So I used what I had to tell the story in the best way I could. I've been accused, I've been, not accused exactly, but people have said to me, just imagine if the plaintiffs wouldn't let you in, but it had been Jerry Fasher who let you into Hale and Dorr and let you see what was going on behind the scenes in this big case. He said you wouldn't have had a book that was nearly as interesting. And I really beg to differ. I think that it would have been a fascinating book. It would have been a vastly different book. It would have been a book about this, how a big law firm deals with a complicated case like this. It would have been a different story. There's no question that the point of view, that once you begin assembling the story, once you begin telling the story through the participants' eyes or how they saw the story, you automatically begin a bias. Are we okay here?
Don't take it personally, Jonathan.
This is an editor of mine at the New Yorker, a guy named John Bennett, wonderful editor, calls it the bias of coherence. To make an event coherent, when you begin trying to make it coherent, you immediately incur a bias in the telling of the story.
And how do you view the reality versus Jonathan's book versus the motion picture? Obviously, you have your own point of view.
I think that the reality of this whole thing is that there were, children that were affected by drinking contaminated water, and those children died. Causing the families to try and find who's responsible for it. I think Jonathan's book, brings out a lot of the reality of it. I'm sure that there's a lot of things that are still missing. Dan was saying, about the federal government agencies being there in the beginning. And yes, they were there, but I think we'd still be waiting for something to be done. If we hadn't gone with Jan and Bill and Kevin. And I can remember at one point one of the government agencies saying that if it ever came to court that they would testify against us. So if it, it just made me believe that there wasn't a very good feeling he was going to be on our side anyhow, to even, find who was responsible for the contamination. But the government is very slow. I just don't think that even so many years later that there'd be a solution. And if it weren't for the case, I don't think that $70 million probably would have, be instituted for cleanup.
Now, Jan, some people say the movie's about you. That the movie is not about Woburn, and it's not about the children, and it's not about the plaintiffs, not even about them. It's about you. As you look at that movie, and must be rather unique to have your life projected by John Travolta, how realistic are you in the movie as compared to Jonathan's book?
Well, people see the movie, in the reviewers, and then they put in their adjectives, and they say, from this movie, it appears that he's flamboyant, charismatic, insensitive, arrogant, greedy, materialistic, a heartless huckster, a humorless vulpine who goes through this experience at the end of which he becomes, almost human. And I think it is true that that I certainly, my character went through an evolution by joining the families in this journey. But I think that the choice of concentrating on my character, the reasoning that went into it to try and make it an interesting film, I can understand. But for me, the film's power is that in the retelling of this story at all. I mean, the fact that this huge $100 million production has been made that allows people to share at least some aspect of this experience, I think, is a is an is
is something that I think we can all take pride in who are involved in this, because it is a story that has meaning for people. So I am a little more forgiving of the inaccuracies, of which there are many. I mean, from my own standpoint, you know, I believe that the film kind of drained out the humanity that connected, you know, me and Bill and Kevin and the three of us with the families. I thought there was, we had a powerful connection, which always remained there throughout the whole process. I think the film kind of drained that out or you know, took a lot of that away, and I think that is missed a lot of the heart of the story, because that's what it was all about. I mean, the families inspired us, and then we went on this journey that we were captured on all these levels that human beings get captured. And I think that part, they did emphasize a lot of our vices, and I know we had one or two virtues. I know we had one or two. There was that going on there. But those are trivial, I think, compared to the fact that this important story was retold so that tens of millions of people can see it and then read the book and then come to a place like this and want to know more.
You think Jonathan's portrayal was more accurate?
Well, I do have problems with Jonathan's portrayal. He said that I was a very lousy dancer, and it's not true, and I state that publicly, and the fact that John Travolta played me, I think, answers that calumny once and for all. Aside from that, I think that Jonathan's story was a powerful evocation of that time. In my reading the experience, you know, the book, it was like reliving the experience in very powerful ways, and I learned in going through, you know, that book about, you know, got a view of that world that I had missed a lot of, because I was insensitive and arrogant and some of those other things on occasion. But so his book allows me to revisit and learn and relearn.
And you, Jerry, I've known you for the 29 years you've been associated with this faculty, and I've never seen a one-to-one correlation between you and Robert Duvall.
Well, that's true, and I'm now getting credit for a lot of things I don't deserve because of Duvall's portrayal. I get, and indeed I get sympathy because I didn't win the Golden Globe. But I'll try and make it up to you all by winning the Oscar. This incidentally, Arthur, is the fifth degree of separation, because we now have a panel talking about a movie, talking about a book, talking about a trial, talking about reality, and the truth may even be beyond that. The movie was a great big ice cream cone with Jimmy's sprinkled on the top, and the ice cream cone was all fiction, and the Jimmy's here and there were reality. I mean, there were people. Jan was a lawyer, and I was a lawyer. There was a case. There was a courtroom. There was a judge named Skinner.
Giving away ice in the wintertime.
So that there was reality, but about 80% of the movie was fiction. All the good scenes never occurred. Nobody in his right mind would leave a $20 bill near Jan Schlickman for a moment. That never happened, but it was a great scene. The cynicism about the legal system is one that I do not share, as those who know me and my students too know that. So the movie, I think, I agree with Dan, is off into another category. The book is a fine piece of writing, which I have admired Jonathan for a long time because of his tenacity or stubbornness or foolhardiness. It was a book I told him nobody would ever buy, that he would sell only three copies and one of the buyers would not be me. So I was as surprised as he was when he sold the rights, probably too cheaply, Jonathan, to the movies, and the book took off, but he didn't get it all right either. What he wrote down was pretty good and pretty accurate. He's very good on the quotes. He double-checked everything. He didn't have the access to the inner circle of defendants as he did with the plaintiffs. He didn't share in defendants' confidences, and obviously he couldn't have been on both sides of the case. So he was a fly or an author on the wall of the plaintiff's camp, but he tried to get it right. I do think, whether he knows it or not, he injected himself quite a lot into the story, although it's not written in the first person. You can feel when you finish the book about how he feels about the situation.
Are you talking about the causation issue?
I'm talking about the general feeling that he had for the families and the general feeling that he had with respect to being attached, if you will, joined at the hip, if you will, to the plaintiff's case. But he tried to make up for that by following me around and talking to me. We had a lot of very bad dinners at Harkness Common for a long time. He had the patience to sit in my trial practice classes and derive what value he could about the law from them. But I think he got it wrong principally about the judge, because he didn't appreciate, I don't think, how judges operate, what they do, and because Judge Skinner, whom you know, Arthur, would not speak to him, and therefore he couldn't, as Jonathan has said, get inside Judge Skinner's mind. And that was my principal objection to Jonathan's recounting. Plus, he had to compress an awful lot of material, so you get a very large book about the trial and then a very short book about the aftermath. And if they'd given him another 500 pages, he could have done a better job there. But it's a remarkable piece of writing to take things like depositions and Rule 11 and motions and make them interesting. Finally, as to Jan, I think the movie does him a disservice, because he wasn't the kind of a flashy, arrogant, cock-of-the-walk kind of lawyer that portrayed. He certainly wasn't an ambulance chaser in the pejorative sense. I observed actually a polite and deferential and I would think somewhat insecure, as I said this morning, lawyer who was taking a case on against the odds. And so I didn't find that degree of slickness and sleaziness, if you will, sort of Travolta kind of says, he's to be given credit for taking the case. Somewhere along the line there was a left turn and things got out of hand. But when he initially first talked with me, as I said to his mother, who I admired very greatly, because she came up to me and said she was reluctant to talk to me because I had been mean to her Jan. And I said that her Jan had been a polite, deferential, and I thought, well-behaved lawyer, just as she had probably taught him.
Kevin, what was it like living with Jonathan? Having him, this outsider, in your camp day in, day out?
Jonathan was, this was a very public case right from the beginning. Long before we were involved, this case was in the news. After we became involved, it was still in the news. It was on 60 Minutes, it was on Nova, it was in the newspapers quite a bit, and this was really a tribute to the families wanting to make this story public. They had been trying for many years to get people to listen to them, to listen to the story. So when Jonathan first came in, actually the families were very happy that he wanted to write a story about this. This was entirely consistent with what their tack had been prior to this time. For us as lawyers, it was quite scary. We had all sorts of issues involved. Privilege, confidential communications, all sorts of things. But we sat down with the families, we discussed everything. They understood the risks they were taking, and there were some risks, but risks were nothing new to them. This is what they were in it for. And after a while, Jonathan became a fly on the wall. I mean, we literally didn't see him. He was there, but he wasn't there. We couldn't, if you asked me if he was there for an event or not there for an event, I wouldn't be able to tell you. He was not a party to anything. He was off in the distance.
And so in the beginning it was novel and bizarre, and in the end it was almost non-consequential.
Do you think the book and or the movie effectively captures the unbelievable pressures imposed on you and Jan?
No, I don't. I often tell people that that as bad as things seemed in the book, it actually was much worse. And as bad as it was in the movie, it was far worse. So I don't think it captures that at all.
Well, the movie has a slightly hysterical tone as the finances are going down the tubes. But life was even worse than that?
Life was even worse than that. That's right.
Did the defense know how bad things were?
You know, we always wanted to do things according to a process. And you see in the movie, they're talking about a process. That means you don't write an offer down on a piece of paper. You don't put a $20 bill on a table. You sit down and you say, we want this amount of money. This is the reason that we think we're entitled to this amount of money. And the other side responds. And part of our process was also to not make financial instability part of the process. That had to be out of the process. Like it could never enter their minds that that we were concerned about our ability to continue the case. And so we went to great extents, especially as we fell deeper and deeper into the hole, we went to great extents to try and hide that. For example, the Four Seasons Hotel, where Jerry Fasher took a pen and a croissant, is a perfect example of our using excess money.
Here we think it's a big day to go to the faculty club.
Right.
Bill, what did you know about their condition? You had to know they were seat of the pants at some point. Michael's shaking his head. You didn't know?
No, I think I have to credit Bill and Jan and Kevin for this, because we had no suspicion, even until we were well into the settlement discussions, that they were under any financial constraints whatsoever.
But you knew they had it on a contingency of that.
No, actually, Arthur, what we believed to be the case, rightly or wrongly, was that there were investors around the country who had in fact invested in what was perceived to be a verdict of perhaps $400 million potentially. We didn't know who the investors were. We heard stories about people in Kentucky. We heard stories about banks. But it never occurred to us that there was any financial pressure on the plaintiffs whatsoever. We truthfully felt, and I'm speaking now for the Grace team, and I think Jerry would probably confirm this, we thought we were pressed to match them dollar for dollar. It was hardly a situation which is sometimes perceived publicly, where the big companies were riding roughshod over the little financially insecure plaintiffs. In reality, that apparently was the case, but that was never something which was manifested itself to us in any way.
Bill, I'm having an out-of-body experience. Everybody knows plaintiffs' firms have cash flow problems. Everybody knows the words scorched earth. Could it be that these two harmless-looking guys snookered you into believing that they were rolling in money?
That is the truth.
Then I'd like to sell you a bridge.
Even when near the beginning of the trial, towards the end of discovery, when the plaintiffs were taking depositions of our experts and spent 20 minutes or half an hour on an expert where we had spent 7 or 8 days deposing their experts, we may have talked about the possibility, but it didn't seem realistic to think that they were out of money. Mike's story about our supposition of investments is correct. Judge Skinner even waived an article once during the trial at Jan that had been published in the New Republic during the trial. I was surprised to think that Judge Skinner subscribed to the New Republic. it was an article accusing, basically telling a story that the plaintiffs had sold investment interests in the case, and Jan denied it, and Judge Skinner accepted that. But one way or another, we assumed that they had all the money in the world because they were spending money hand over fist at every stage of the case. The amount of money, as an environmental lawyer for 20 years, I know how much money it costs to put drilling rigs out on a site and the backhoes and to get the scientists in there putting their results through lab tests and so on. And Jan had all those drilling rigs out at the Grace site.
Yeah, for those who don't know, it cost $600,000.
And we encouraged them to dig holes everywhere on the property, knowing that it would drain their cash reserves. But, you know, two or three years after the trial, I was at an ABA conference down in South Carolina, and James Gordon, played by William Macy in the movie, happened to be there too. So we went out for beer at lunch, and he told me about the $1 million loan from the Bank of Boston, which was the first I'd ever heard of it, first any of us had ever heard of it. And that was an astonishing thing to me to hear that the biggest commercial bank in New England loaned $1 million to plaintiff's lawyers who were suing a big, you know, Fortune 500 company. And it confirmed my sense that we were right, in a sense, to think that they had access to immense amounts of money.
So looking back on it, do you feel stupid?
No, I wouldn't say so.
Or to put it more benignly, Bill.
I try not to.
Would you have done anything differently if you knew that they were on the verge of bankruptcy?
I think, as people often ask, would we have done, let's say, would I have done anything different? I don't want to speak for Bill necessarily here. And now knowing what we know, obviously, there is something we would have done. Maybe we should have been more perceptive about it, although in truth, I think we can see the signs of people who are in financially exigencies, and we didn't see those signs, whether it was the $1,200 suits or it was the Four Seasons or whatever it was that they did constantly. But I think probably now what I would have been more aggressive about was poking at the financial exigency possibility, picking up what you said, Arthur, about it was a plaintiff's case, it probably was on a contingency, and probably trying to see earlier on in the course of the litigation whether or not there might have been a situation there which I didn't realize existed, which might have made a settlement a more likely scenario than I believed it to be during the trial.
Now, Mary, you're laughing your head off over there. What's funny to you about this money business?
Well, when Jan was selling everything and all their houses up, I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh my God, they're crazy. What are they doing? You know, why are they doing that? You know, in the movie, they kind of, you know, show that, how, was it Gordon in the movie saying, he says, put my house up for collateral or whatever, and he says, we already have. Yeah. And then when we were going into the office for different meetings, different things were disappearing. You know? Like, oh my God, you know?
Now, when you talked among yourselves about this lunatic,
Well, we thought he was crazy. You know, we said, oh my God, things are really rough. You know, like I said, he was selling off stuff and their houses, and I felt bad for the families, their wives. Imagine being their wife, you know. It was frightening.
As you look back on it, you now know the financial burdens that they assumed.
I know.
Emotionally, how do you react to that?
Well, it worked out in the end, you know, but it was, you know, it was quite a risk that they took.
And you're being very quiet about that.
What did you want me to say?
Far be it from me to put words in your mouth.
I think some monies were spent frivolously. I don't think that we needed to go to the Four Seasons or
a Holiday Inn would have been good enough.
Yeah, you know, I don't think we had to have prison in the glass. I'm not talking about we, I'm talking about the experts. But that was Jan's way, and he had been successful in doing it that way before. I know Jan made mistakes, and everybody makes mistakes. I'm not sure that the opposing attorneys made them or will ever admit to it, but I'm proud to say that I believe that we were on the right side. Mm-hmm. And so I'm grateful to Jan for that. And I know that he worked very hard in our behalf.
You know, in a real sense, their decision not to show the financial strain, not to reveal the precariousness of their position, it worked. I mean, for whatever reason, this very experienced crew thought they were rolling in money, that they were more formidable than arguably they were.
Could I would like to just say, I'm trying to understand the why, and I think the movie, you know, touches on this in a way, I think, which has a lot of truth to it, and I think Jonathan's book certainly gives, you know, greater complexity to it. It became an obsession. One has to understand that. You know, when you look back at this, you say, well, that was crazy. You know, why would you have done it? Well, let me explain something to you. You know, the families came to us with this story, and as I say, it, you know, it did capture us, and it took a long time, but we were captured by it on all the levels, you know, the good and the bad and the ugly. You know, we were caught up in their story. They were very inspiring. They were very determined. And, you know, I'm talking about people, you know, all I can say to you is that, you know, sitting at this table is a woman who challenged scientists, doctors, lawyers, politicians, the general public, challenged them to join in this journey, to take this, you know, what was happening in Woburn seriously. Now, there's an aspect of that personality which is somewhat magical. We got caught up in that challenge. It was hard to say no to that challenge. Now, once caught up, let me tell you how it was addictive. You see, you sensed in the story that had important meaning for you personally, for your own family, for your own life. And then when we started looking, the more we looked, the more we found. And yeah, it was costing money, but the more holes we dug, the more stuff came out, or the more tests that were done on the families, you know, medical tests, scientific tests that had never been done before. We were having scientists from all around the country, you know, neurologists and psychologists and psychiatrists for me and Bill and Kevin, and, hematologists. We had all the kinds of ologists in the world you could have all in one room at one time, and they're all getting all excited about all these findings. Oh, I never knew this before. You know, we did this neurological or neuropsychological test. Look, it shows the same in the families as it is with workers exposed to these chemicals at much higher levels. Oh, we did this test over here, and look, the water wasn't, the exposure wasn't drinking it. No, it was just sitting in the home. You see, this stuff all flies in the air, and all this exciting stuff was happening. Now, granted, we were writing the checks, but it was addictive because the more you wrote, the more that was done, the more you found on the story that had already captured you. You couldn't say no to that. And when they asked,
Wait a second. What do you mean you couldn't say no? You got a room full of young lawyers and law teachers, and you're describing, with great honesty, I suspect, the reality that in the practice of the law, our profession, you can become obsessed, you can become addictive, and those two powerful forces can turn you positively or negatively. It can be constructive or destructive.
Right.
And somehow the individual has to calibrate those forces. So what did you learn? Are you still capable of being obsessed and addicted?
Yeah. I am. I am
obsessive. Is that good or bad?
Well, it's the only way I know. I'm 100%, whatever it is. But I think that I've learned that it's nice to involve a whole bunch of other people in the obsession. It makes it more security in it.
Or it's easier to be obsessed of somebody assigning checks.
So that's right. But this is what Ann did. This is what Donna did. This is what Mary did. They made people become obsessed with who you are now, here in this room. Because you've become, you've caught the obsession. And this it's not a sickness. It's actually a wellness. It is a sense that this story has meaning for you personally. You have to get it right. You know, how do you explain Jonathan's 9-year obsession with the story? Forget our obsession. Forget, you know, the family's, you know, 25-year obsession. You know, how about Jonathan's, or how about Zalian's 3-year obsession? How do you explain it, or your obsession here? And the way I explain it is, it's stuff that we can think about and things maybe we can't know, but we sense in this story of what happened. You know, through Jimmy becomes the archetype of our future. He is our children. He is our future. And it's because there's something happened there that we must understand, because if we're going to have a future, we must understand it. Now, that's what captures you. And once captured, there ain't no going back. You know, Kevin, when this thing was all over, and, you know, when all the debris was out there and there was nothing left, I mean nothing, he said he'd do it all over again. And I know what he means. And it's true, because you had to give up. The Woburn demanded you gave up all the things for the most important thing, for the only thing, and that was life itself. That's the magic of Woburn. That's when they came to our office, that's what they were introducing us to.
But the obligation of a lawyer is a little different. The obligation of a lawyer is to his or her client and not to his or her obsession. And the obligation of a lawyer is not only to represent the client properly, but to also tell the client what the problems of the case are. And so you can have an obsession, you can believe in the cause, but you can still be a good lawyer, and I hope the students I teach and the faculty members I associate with remember that, because it is not the lawyer's job to further the greater dream of mankind as much as he may believe in it. The lawyer's job is to represent a client, whether he's taking money from that client or whether he's taking 40% of that client's recovery. And that's what you can't lose sight of. And I do not fault the strategy of appearing to be obsessed or of actually being obsessed. I mean, part of the obsession consisted not only of concern for the families, but also desire to win became mixed up in there somewhere.
Absolutely.
And greed became mixed up
Absolutely.
In there somewhere.
Absolutely.
So, and that's not unnatural either. So I think at some point, Arthur says your strategy succeeded. It succeeded in giving us the impression that you would go to the mat, but it wasn't a good tactic because you weren't going to be able to go to the mat. So the tactic should have been, or I hope should have been, and Kevin explained why in one of the smaller sessions, explained it. The tactic should have been, this case is going to be an enormous case. It has enormous risks. It may not be a winnable case because the science isn't there. We represent clients. There's no provision in the federal rules, Arthur, that gives relief in the form of an apology. I never saw a complaint that says I hereby demand an apology. So money is the only thing you can do for your client. And this case, I thought wasn't winnable, but I thought it was settleable. And having, you know, fooled us into indicating that you could go the distance, that was the time to talk turkey and try and settle the case. And we're all asked, what would you do differently? And I say, I wouldn't do anything terribly differently from what the plaintiff did, but I would get this case settled earlier, and I would have put a figure on the table earlier, and I would have come over and talked turkey with Jerry Fasher or Mike Keating earlier. And if they suggested that you could have $1 million, which is what was first suggested, I would have tested that to see how far up that was going, and if I could separate Grace from Beatrice, I would have done that, and then maybe pursue the dream, pursue the obsession against a single defendant. So,
well, let's stick with that. That's what he says you should have done.
Well, we had many discussions about that. You know, we were obsessed, but not stupid. We certainly talked about these things, and we had a lot of intelligent folks putting their little brains on this, and obviously it was not lost on us. One of the strategies was, yeah, sure, settle with one and use those resources to go after the other. Now, we'd already done a function of that because we had settled with Universe. You know, some of the money that was obtained was from a $1 million settlement with Universe that then, you know, led to Jerry's calling me up and said, hey, you want some more? And I remember that. And we went to your office and to have that little discussion. But here was our dilemma. It was basically that you had these two companies, one on each side of the wells, and Beatrice was perceived by us as the closer one and the bigger polluter, although we had less strong facts about direct pollution. It was all indirect, circumstantial. Where Grace was much further away, and we had direct evidence, but, you know, greater distances. Now, our problem was that if we did settle for Beatrice, here was our major problem. If they were out, yes, we'd have the money, whatever it was, and then we'd be able to go against Grace. But when we did that, we would be providing Grace the defense, the empty chair defense, which would have been quite powerful. Hey, the biggest polluter, you know, is already gone and out of here, and now their arguments about being much farther away would have, I think, fertile ground. And so we had to balance, and also, whatever amount we settled with Beatrice would be an amount that they would naturally say to the judge, or naturally say to us, hey, you know, we want, you know, we'll do that, or something like that. And so all of those things had to be calculated in, and that was the dance that we were going through. me and Neil and us and Jerry, and we never, you know, unfortunately, because of the context, we never got to an open and honest discussion, I think, which would have allowed it to settle. But those things were the things that were weighing on our minds.
You don't buy that, Jerry?
It seems...
Well,
that I mean,
empty there, are three, there are three parties in the case. I'm not trying to, I don't mean to be critical of what Jan just said, but the way to handle that problem was to settle with both of us. I mean, in other words, I'm being quite serious. I mean, if you worried that we'd point to the empty chair, if you settle with Fasher and had the funds to go after us, I suppose the way to work against that risk was to see if you could wrap the whole case up.
Absolutely.
Against it. Let me just give my take on the... I've often said that I thought the difference between the way the plaintiffs and the defendants approached this case was the plaintiffs thought they had a cause and the defendants thought they had a case. And I think it's a very dangerous thing for lawyers, and I think Jerry's already alluded to it, to approach cases, things that go into court, as if they are causes and not cases. Because I not only think it stands in the way of effective settlement discussion, I think it stands in the way of effective advocacy within the courtroom. Because I think if you're so imbued with the notion that you're on the side of right, that I think it tends to make you make tactical judgments, and this is maybe more for your law students, what I'm saying now. I can recall one instance in this trial where Jan was cross-examining a witness. I don't know if I've ever told him this story. And I thought he was getting exactly the wrong answers, at least the answers I couldn't imagine he wanted to get. It was Jack Gussois, it was somebody, I don't even remember who it was. He kept asking the questions, he kept getting the answers. I thought, he can't possibly want to keep asking this witness questions. Sandy Lynch, now a federal judge, was sitting on my left, and she pulled my arm, and she said, "You know what he's like?" And I said, "No, what's he like? I have some ideas what he's like, but what do you think he's like?" She said, "He's like a Moorish warrior." And I said, "What do you mean he's like a Moorish warrior?" Sandy said, "He is so convinced that he's on the side of right, that he's like the Moorish warriors who would go into battle, and they knew that Allah was on their side, and the arrows would come back against them, but they thought they were invincible. And that therefore they would do things that they maybe necessarily shouldn't have been doing." And in this instance, I thought the questions Jan were asking he shouldn't have asked. So I use that as an example of where I think the real dangers are in the case versus cause thing, because I think it candidly affects the way you present the evidence in the courtroom.
But isn't it also in some small measure, and maybe I'm simply reflecting my own experiences working on both sides of the V in my lifetime, what you're really describing is a basic sociological difference between people who practice on the left side of the V and people who practice on the right side of the V. That part of their high is that emotional involvement. They've got to have it.
Well, if that's the case, and I'm not sure I accept that, because I think there are lots of people who are on the left side of the aisle who approach cases as cases, but I think there are real dangers to that. And I think in many respects, what happened in this case may reflect that view that I've expressed. Whereas I think the eye was not on the rules, the procedural, the things that had to be done in that courtroom to succeed in that courtroom. The eye was on the obsession and the cause.
Yeah, I would like to comment a little bit on what Mike said. And I agree, Mike, that it was a cause from our standpoint. It certainly was a cause. It was not a case. It was our first cause. We'd had several cases prior to that time. This was our first cause. Actually, a lot of it, much of it had to do with Charles Nessens coming into the case. As people in our earlier session may have heard, we were originally going to be just local counsel here for Trial Lawyers of Public Justice, a Washington-based firm. And Trial Lawyers was going to handle all the legal talent and all the funding, but right after the Rule 11 motion, Trial Lawyers disappeared. And we were really listing at that point until Charlie Nessen became involved in the case to help us with evidentiary issues. And we became convinced, all of us, as part of his cause, the plaintiffs, our experts, all the lawyers, Charlie, that we were right, that the water had caused leukemias, that the companies were going to deny every aspect of their involvement, and we were upset. And
you also believed you'd make a pile of money.
No, we believed that the case had to end a certain way. The case could either end with a verdict in our behalf, or it could end with a settlement, which would be enough to make a statement that that the environmental problems caused by these companies had been noticed by them in this way. It was really it never became a case about money for the lawyers, even right from the beginning. This was a case that we weren't taking, that we didn't want to take, that we somehow were wound up with. And then we became, I don't know if obsessed is the word, but it certainly was a cause. This was a cause that had to end the right way. Because if we settled for small money, then it would have been about money. And that couldn't be. And so we maybe deluded ourselves that we'd be able to get to a verdict. Hindsight's 20/20. But it was a cause, and I think that it was a just cause. And I feel that way today.
Harriet, let me get you involved. You had the most unique perspective, at least with regard to the trial, when you sat there and watched these lawyers. Did you sense obsession on the part of the plaintiffs?
Oh, wow. Obsession. You could tell they were out for their cause. I guess that. You know, you asked me obsession, I really... That's kind of a hard statement to make. I'm trying very hard to listen to all the evidence that they're putting to us. Trying not to involve personalities here.
And as you look at the movie, do you think the movie accurately portrays the trial that you participated in?
No.
Why not?
That's based on a true story. And the word is based. That's it. And it had nothing to do with my 6 months sitting in a courtroom, dozing off at evidence, watching the...
What was that?
Dozing?
Dozing off.
Oh, sure.
Is that a technical term?
No, sir. I think somebody kicked Judge Skinner once when he dozed twice. Right.
So the film doesn't capture the tedium of the trial?
Couldn't possibly. But not possibly.
Beyond description, huh?
Beyond. I sit in my seat. Yeah.
What else would you say is unreal in the movie from your perspective? The movie does portray it as very complicated, all these efforts to give you questions to answer.
Oh, yes. Gave us a lot of questions at the end to answer. It couldn't possibly be answered.
Couldn't possibly be answered.
No, sir. We had a question, four questions, and chemicals that had to be questioned. Certain dates, say May 22nd of 1979, from August something of 68, whether TCE or 1,2,3 trichloroethylene and two other chemicals, did they contaminate the wells? When did they contaminate the wells? And did Beatrice do it? Yes or no? And four of those, and three more pages after that. If you got through the first three, four questions, you could continue. That was for each side, Grace and Beatrice. And after that, I mean, we basically just laughed. I mean, what else was there to do? I mean, when you get into a jury room and they say, okay, what do you want? How do you feel? And you just look at questions. You are going from memory. No notes were taken that we could do in the jury room. After 6 months, back in the beginning of 6 months, you were trying to remember what you had heard the first time. I told them this morning in the little conference we had, I had a list of 159 witnesses for one company, 139 for another one, and 154 for another. And they handed us these and said, do you know anybody? No. If you do, let us know. Then you give me test borings. You give me water samples. Are you? I don't see anybody that even remotely, and you're not discussing anything about this or how these chemicals caused all this. I don't know anything about the families. I wasn't familiar with that. So you've asked a layperson to do a job here that was almost impossible.
Did it all seem sort of sterile?
I don't think sterile.
I mean, the actual plaintiffs never testified.
I never saw, didn't know these ladies, didn't know their cases. I mean, after seeing the movie, I get a call from South Carolina from my sister, and she says, how could you not find for those people when they were on the bridge there with their child dying in their hands, in their arms? I didn't know that. How was I supposed to know that? These guys never told me that, either one of them.
How about that, Jan?
Let me defend Jan.
Right.
Jan made a wonderful opening. The best thing about the trial was Jan's opening. And he was not restricted in any way in his opening just to what he was talking about in what we call the first phase of the case. And it was a very, very powerful and good opening, and I say that as a teacher and as a colleague and as an adversary. He brought home to the jury what that case was all about, beginning with talking about there's a small town in Woburn, and it's like a lot of small towns, but it has a big difference. It has death and it has cancer. It was clear, if you were listening to that opening, what this case was all about. And that opening impressed me, and I can say honestly it impressed everybody else. So this case, the jury knew what the case was about. To switch to the questions, in fact, the first question was not a difficult question to answer. The hard questions to answer were the questions about travel times and why chemicals move through groundwater at certain speeds and whether they reach the wells. But the first question dealt with use and disposal of these chemicals, which is not a difficult question. The harder questions are asked juries every day in the week in patent cases, in antitrust cases, in product liability cases, in medical malpractice cases, in hundreds and hundreds of cases. And it was a question that said, did these companies use and dispose of this chemical? And I've used the analogy before of saying, do you use vinegar when you make scrambled eggs? And that could be answered. The other questions were, in fact, hard. And the jury decided, and I think they evaluated, what the evidence was on question one, which was there use and disposal? And they answered question one differently for Beatrice than they did for Grace. So that I think, and they were out 8.5 days, so believe me, they were going over the evidence carefully, and as Harriet told us in the small session, they spent a lot of time even discussing whether Mr. Dubinsky had gotten his degree from Melbourne, Australia, when he said he had, or when he said he claimed he had a degree. That attention to the evidence, I thought, was admirable. So there was the ability there, and it was an intelligent jury. I'm sure that's true. And there was an ability to distinguish, and the case was from the opening about these children. Now, they were eventually going to testify if Jan and the plaintiffs got through what was called the waterworks phase of the case, which is a segue for you, Arthur, to ask about the bifurcation order, which I know you're interested in. But he's looking at me like, yeah, it's trying to one-up me. The waterworks phase of the case was one that they were very confident about. And they were confident, and I would have had some confidence if I were they, because they had leading experts. They had wonderful experts. They had good experts. that were going to come in and give opinions. And if they got through the waterworks part of the case, as Judge Skinner called it, then the defendants were then going to be naked to their enemies because there was nothing left for the defendants to do but cross-examine injured people and poor people who were victimized, and that was going to be a terrible burden. So they would have then had a really strong finish to their case, which many tacticians think is a better way to wind up a trial than begin it. So if they'd gotten through the waterworks section of the case, there would have been a really boffo finale. The fact that the plaintiffs didn't testify was not due to any court order or any prevention. It's just that they didn't get through the phase of the case that dealt with the geology.
Well, Jerry, you do a marvelous job of defending Jan and defending the jury system. But it's a little bit like Rashomon right now. When I've got a juror here who says there was 6 months of tedium and the questions were beyond comprehension. And you're telling me she comprehended them.
Yes, I think she did, and I think she said in the book she comprehended. At least.
Well, which is it, Harry?
Well, I have a copy of the questions if anybody wants to see them.
It sounds as if you've got them memorized.
No, I don't, but I have a copy of the questions that were given to us.
But doesn't this really raise another issue, Arthur, that if we have faculty members from lots of law schools around the country that I hope they spend some time on as they take this case up as a sample or an example of complex litigation? And isn't that the question as to whether or not the system that we employed in this particular case to arrive at the truth in very serious issues was in fact adequate to arrive at the truth? I made a comment in a similar form a few weeks ago, and people read my comment as a suggestion that I didn't think the juries should hear these cases. But let's assume that we have such an investment in the jury system in this country that we're always going to have the opportunity to have cases tried before people like Harriet and others. It seems to me, accepting that fact, there is still plenty of room within the system that we have now for improvements in how we communicate evidence to people like Harriet and other jurors, how we make it more understandable to them. Harriet said a moment ago that she could, it had a tough time, and well, she might have, remembering what was said early in the case, later in the case. And it strikes me that the real fertile ground for academics to focus on moving from today to the future, to the next millennium, if you will, is how can we develop a procedural and evidentiary system for jury trials where they are really able to give more help to jurors.
Yeah, Jerry teases me about my sort of perverse interest in bifurcation, or trifurcation, which is more accurate in this case. That procedure, as well as the procedure of giving specific questions to Harriet, those were thought of as procedures devised to help jurors understand complex cases.
They didn't ask us to go in there with these questions and say that these chemicals caused death in these children. All it said to us in these questions was, when did it contaminate this well? That's all they wanted to know. And when did it do it? Not there was anything caused. I remember his opening statements and talking about death in Woburn and the small town in Woburn. And I've made the comment before, where was Woburn? Well, coming from Pembroke on the South Shore, I really didn't know where Woburn was. And he enlightened us to that in this small little town, not unlike the one that I live in. But that wasn't the question that the jury got. Those were not the questions that we were asked to answer. And I think it's important for lawyers and all of you in here, we're not scientists, you put us on this jury. We're just ordinary people, our ordinary housewives and mothers. Give us, you know, not just a yes or no. Make it so that we can understand it. Make it so that it comes across to us.
Looking back at it, Jan, again, what would you do differently? In this case, Jerry said you didn't get your plaintiffs on because of the structuring of the case.
Right.
Should you have fought harder about the bifurcation, trifurcation? And even if you lost that fist fight, should you have had your clients in the courtroom, physically in the courtroom? So Harriet, looking at counsel table, didn't see just a bunch of starched shirts.
Right, but they wouldn't have been able to sit at the table with us. You know, they would have been lost in a sea of people, you know, in the back. And we're talking about a trial that went on for, we didn't know how long, but it went on, actually ended being, I don't know, 9 months.
But you could have ostentatiously conferred with them periodically.
Yeah, I could have, but then they would have, you know, one of the decisions we made tactically was if they're going to be there, they'd have to be there every day, not when they wanted to be there. And there's no way that, you know, these were working families. They had to go earn a living, and most of them were, some were single family, and some of them were you know, two wage earners in the family. So that was not, you know, that was possible. So that was a tactical decision we can make, and people can argue about that. When people ask me, though, you know, mistakes I made, you know, I think the answer I think that is most revealing is that, you know, the mistakes I made could fill a book, you know, and did. Read Jonathan's book, you know. A lot of mistakes there, you know. Start on page one and go all the way to page 500. But I think that the fundamental mistake that I made was one that I had to go through this experience to learn. And that was the mistake of looking at the truth in a way that allowed me to participate in the system, which I think gave us little hope of resolving the reason, the problem, which was the reason that the families first came to us. You see, they came to us with a problem. And when they came to us with the problem, I said, oh, my job is to take the problem and make a case out of it. And this case is, you know, one side wins, one side loses, and truth is the weapon in that war. You know, and it is a war, and it has to be described as a war, and the truth, you know, looked at as a weapon, you know, truth is a commodity. Truth is something that you can bury at the bottom of a bottomless pit, and therefore you have to go into the pit, you got to unbury it, you know, and bring it out, and you get well paid, you know, for this very valuable commodity. And when you look at the truth as a commodity, when you look at it as something, a valuable commodity that one person wants to keep and the other person wants to take, and then it's, therefore it's justified to fight over it, then you're destroying the very thing you say you're trying to obtain, which is, you know, an understanding that allows you to do the right thing. So our system, I've come to appreciate, this system of civil justice is more system than civil or just. And there's a systemic reason for it. It's not because there was a bad judge. And people can argue that he made good decisions, bad decisions. To me, it's not the appropriate. The more appropriate question is this mechanism that we have? And I think the discussion today has been very revealing in that way. When we sit down like we are today and we talk to each other, we are having an open and honest discussion, and we all get enlightened. And we'll all have a better appreciation for this journey that we all went on, having had this discussion. If this was a trial today over it, we would not have the same enlightenment that we have now, because the conflict model, like all wars, wastes time and money and people, and casualty is the first truth. It's a distorting process, and it's a process that emphasizes delusion and pathology rather than minimizing it. And it does it for the client, and it does it for their lawyers, and it does it lawyer to opposing lawyer. And that, to me, I found to be very, very destructive. It was a 9-year war. Now, I'm proud of that war. We're all veterans in that war. Very proud of having fought. I'm very proud of the side that we fought on. We believed, like all veterans, you know, that we believe we fought on the right side. But I have to tell you, after going through war and surviving, I come out like any veteran of any war. Why war? And I also come, the families have taught me, we can't afford the war because their community, the reason they came to us was their community was threatened. They had gone away from this personal tragedy, this overwhelming tragedy, and realized, oh my God, it's not just about Jimmy, it's about everybody's child. Now I have a personal responsibility to get to the bottom of it and get other people obsessed about this problem that affects everybody. And that's what's going on here. That's the magic of this experience. And once you understand that, then the obligation becomes just, and Michael touched on it. What you're really saying, when I hear you say that, is you're saying, for God's sakes, how about if we start the process with not slap a suit on me, but how about we start the process with a phone call? Like, listen, I have some families who came to me and they say, can we talk about this? I mean, how about if we started the process, suppose I had done that. I mean, I never would have thought to have done that. I mean, and if I had suggested it, I'm sure that, you know, people would have thought I was insane. But how about that? Giving enough respect to the other side, even though you think they've done this terrible thing, to sit down and talk about it. And then see if maybe, you know, your little vision of reality is not really the whole complete reality. There's a whole other complexity you've got to add to that to understand, and maybe they would do the same. I like starting it that way.
So this is the new Jan Slick.
Yeah, I know. Everybody says, I'm going to be old Jan.
This is the reborn Jan Slick.
Well, I went through a 9-year, you know, I mean, you can't go through this experience and not learn. And I hope I did. I mean, if anybody thinks that this was a, you know, we achieved marvelous things, but it took us 9 years, and at what cost? I bet you we could have done it all, you know, within a very short period. I know we can, because we're doing it in other cases. They're not cases, actually. We're actually solving the problem, because we're working together. When we work together, we solve them. When we don't, we can't. But we can do it as lawyers, you know, for our respective positions, and really do lawyering that is the highest calling of law. Problem solving, not problem making.
Without getting off on a rap on ADR, and
there's no alternative to dispute resolution, except resolving.
Well, I just wondered whether the old fogey in the crowd wanted to defend the old-fashioned way of doing things.
Well, I think, yes, I do want to defend the old-fashioned way of doing things and commend the present way of doing things. There's certainly room for people to talk about their disputes before they bring a lawsuit. I have dozens of cases in the offing where all we're doing is talking, because people have called up and said, hey, we think we have a claim, and I say, come on over and we'll talk about it. That is may sound new, but it's been going on in 50 years almost that I've been practicing. Happens all the time. I have at any one given time on my desk a number of agreements where neither party, where both parties have decided that they are not going to sue each other for a given period of time. The so-called standstill agreement that law students know about, everybody knows about, are not new, they're not revolutionary. We do it all the time. So I think there's room for both. There are some cases that eventually are going to trial. And even though you start out talking, eventually the talks break down if two sides aren't reasonable or they're too far apart, and you have to go the next step. There will always be litigation. Unfortunately, in our society, people start suing a lot too early. When I was a kid in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, it was a crime. It was a shame in society if you were, quote, taken to court. That was a terrible thing, to be taken to court. Now people sue first, including those of you out there in the audience who have done it, and talk second. So I'm a great believer in both. But in this one, Jan will have to concede that he declared war first. And the first I knew about this, unless he talked to somebody that I don't know about, was when the complaint arrived on my desk.
All right, as we leave the gentle shores of Pearl Harbor, let's go to the audience. This is your opportunity to ask questions of the panelists or to make any observations you would like to make. So let's not be bashful. Yes. Mics here and there. So come on down to the mics. Yeah, you can form a little line. It's all right.
Rob Lesser from Arkansas. This is directed to Michael Keating and Bill Cheeseman, please. Michael, you said that had you had a clue that the plaintiffs' counsel were in the financial straits that they were in, you might have pushed a little harder. You might have poked a little bit harder. And as I gather, your general paradigm of representation is you do the best you can for your client within the bounds of ethics. What does that mean that you would have pushed a little harder? Would you have had investigators look into the firm's creditors? How far does that go?
No. What I meant was I might have been a little more circumspect about the fact that they were a small firm. They had a big case. It was obviously costing them a lot of money. And I might have tried to find out, and I never would have hired an investigator to do it. I probably would have done something to ask them. I would have opened a dialogue with them in some fashion to find out whether or not we had a more some grounds to approach settlement. If I had to be direct about it, I probably would have been direct about it. But I wasn't thinking of going out and checking their credit ratings.
Why wouldn't you have hired an investigator if you, for example, had a plaintiff who you thought was putting on a show? You might have hired an investigator to check out that plaintiff's story.
Well, let me ask, if Bill may want to answer part of this. I don't think it would have been something we would have normally thought to have done. I mean, it's just that I think in I wouldn't normally think it's part of my business to go, frankly, snooping around to find out what the financial wherewithal of my opponents are. I meant to say I probably, in some more direct way, would have tried to find out whether there was a weakened system situation there, which maybe could have found the formed the basis for a settlement.
Let me also say, I think one of the obvious things that might have happened differently if we had known of their financial troubles is we might not have settled the case, or we might not have settled for as much. It was a matter of some reluctance, at least among the lawyers, that we settled when we did anyway. So that might have been a different outcome. At the same time, I want to say, all this is echoing a little bit of what we've already talked about, I tried to open a settlement dialogue with Jan in 1982, as I recall, whenever we were co-panelists on a program down in Cape Cod, and after one of the rehearsals, I went out, Jan and I walked out together, and we're walking down the sidewalk, and I brought up the subject of possible settlement. I'm never bashful about doing that. And Jan chuckled and changed the subject. I don't know whether you remember that, Jan.
I remember.
I'm curious to know what your thinking was at that time.
I think that, what was my thinking at that time? That's a very good question. I think basically that the, I don't think it was actually 82, I think it was actually maybe 83, a little longer.
Yeah, right.
I don't have a really quick answer. Let me see if I can think about that. I guess that I was unsure of my position. I probably did not have enough self-confidence of the case. You know, this thing had, there were so many aspects of the case, it was so dimensional, there were so many unknowns to it, I did not have the comfortableness or the security to be able to even to know what value it had or didn't have at that the stage that you were asking. So I'm sure that had a lot to do with my thinking. I remember going back and talking to Kevin and Bill about our conversation, because one of the things we prided ourselves on, actually, was in putting our cases together and then presenting it, you know, in a non in a non-courtroom setting, in a hotel, usually, and then presenting our case and getting a discussion going that way. We were kind of, you know, we were used to doing that. And we were saying, why don't we do that here? But the problem with us was there was so many questions and few answers, we couldn't put something on. And so we didn't have an understanding of the value. So in many ways, it had no value, because the work had not been done to give it the value or to even know what it was. And so, you know, going back to case cause, you know, at that point, was it even a case to present to you to resolve? So that would be almost nuisance value. How can we convince you to do more than just pay nuisance value? So I think there was a lot of that insecurity and lack of confidence of what we were doing or what we had.
Jonathan?
I'd like to ask the defense attorneys to what extent they think that obfuscation, actually sort of fogging the air, is a legitimate tool. Not to say that they did this, I'm just saying in the hypothetical. To what extent is obfuscation a legitimate tool in the war that is a trial, with a particular attention perhaps to the questions that Harriet mentioned that from all accounts were incredibly complicated, difficult to get through, and if you can't figure them out, if you have to throw up your hands as a jury when you look at them, the default then is that the defense wins because the burden of proof rests.
It has no place whatsoever. It's a stupid tactic, and it's not certainly not employed in any cases that I'm involved in. And the reason is that I have confidence in the jury system and I have confidence in myself. When I select jurors, the first most important attribute of a juror is intelligence, because I can appeal to intelligent jurors with facts. And when lawyers say, and when students say to me, this case is too complicated for the jury, they'll never understand it, that's a comment on the lawyer. It is not a comment on the jury. And it is the lawyer's job to take a complicated situation and to simplify it and generalize it in a truthful way and present it to the jury. Now, that is not always true, for on the plaintiff's side, not necessarily in this case. There are many plaintiffs who get money from defendants because their client is a tremendously sympathetic client. There are many plaintiffs who excuse people from the jury with any intelligence, with any business background, with any kind of professional background. So you are trying cases with people without a high school education or sometimes a grade school education or without ever having a job. And that type of thing simply is something I never consider in defending a case. I like to try an intelligent case and argue the facts to an intelligent jury.
In some respects, without intending to, we did obfuscate by taking too much time and putting too much detail on. It was striking to listen to the jurors talk to the newspaper reporters right after the case was over. It really did seem like they had had too much to digest, this particular jury at least. I have tried similar cases involving groundwater issues, less complicated, but similar cases with much shorter trials, and juror comments have indicated that they understood everything completely. It can be done. I think maybe deliberately trying to obfuscate isn't a good tactic, as Jerry says, because it increases the uncertainty rather than decreasing the uncertainty of an outcome. But we could have helped everything here, I think, by doing it in less time.
Kevin?
Yeah, I'd just like to comment on that. You know, whether anybody intentionally obfuscated or not, certainly the result in the Woolman case was obfuscation. We, as plaintiffs, it's our burden. It's our burden to persuade the jury by 51% that we're right. And we need, in this case, we needed to get into the courtroom. We needed as brief a discovery time as possible. We needed as few witnesses as possible. And we needed those witnesses on the stand as few days as possible. And we never envisioned that phase one of this case would go for 78 days. We thought it would last maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And this is something that we struggled against during the whole trial. Our constant battle was to get to a verdict. And whether or not it was your intention, it certainly killed us that our witnesses were allowed to be cross-examined by Judge Skinner in one case. Witness was cross-examined for 12 days. You know, we had him mapped out for one day. And whether it was a tactic or not, it certainly had a large measure in confusing the jury, the fact that it was allowed to go on for so long. But that was our burden, to make it simple, and we failed in that burden.
I'm John Farrago from CUNY Law School, and I guess I have a question for the panel about the panel. It's sort of interesting to me that there are representatives of every aspect of the trial, but there are no defendants sitting at the table. And I think there are lots of reasons for that, some of which are that the defendants aren't people. But I think there are implications about that, too. I'm curious what you think are the reasons and the implications, and in particular, how the plaintiffs feel about the absence of the defendants.
Let me answer first of all, correct one thing that you said. Representative W.R. Grace is here today, the person I've worked with throughout the case, and he was asked to sit in the audience now just to make, you know, the number of seats work here. He was prepared to be on the panel.
And there's no significance whatsoever in the fact that Beatrice is not here because there is no Beatrice. The company doesn't exist. The company was a conglomerate. The company made orange juice and Playtex bras and peanut butter and
water bottles.
Yeah, and Samsonite luggage and all the nice things. Every one of those divisions has been sold off, so there is no company.
Does that happen to all your clients?
It does. It does. It's a piece of good fortune. It's been following me around all my life.
I'm Philip Schrag from Georgetown Law School. The statement was made that cases have to be about money. But, of course, that's not always true. And so I was wondering if the plaintiffs thought that there was, considered whether there was any basis in Massachusetts law for asking for an injunction regarding cleanup of the property, whether they asked for an injunction, whether there was consideration to asking for a preliminary injunction. Of course, the wells had been closed, but the land was still quite polluted. And whether in the settlement discussions, there might have been a settlement early on in the case for the payment of a small amount of money, an apology, perhaps no apology, but a considerable amount of change in business practices to prevent further environmental degradation.
The answer is we did have it in our complaint, equitable relief, but it was an add-on because the EPA was already involved in the area, and so was the state environmental agency, and so any move on our part to do any kind of equitable relief would come, very quickly to the
you know, that's in the province of the federal government, which declared the area, you know, Superfund area. Well, G&H area Superfund. So there's no, there wouldn't have been any realistic, you know. In fact, you know, the little clash of those two things came when we tried to get a court order to go onto the Grace property to do more digging on the Beatrice property, and that all had to be done, you know, through the, you know, so for discovery purposes to get on there, that all had to be done through the federal government. So it was that layer of complication to answer your question. I think the other one, though, is about one of the aspects of the settlement was participating in the cleanup, because that decision had not been made yet, and that would have gone a long way. And in fact, we had kind of primitive discussions about that, and unfortunately never really pursued it, because I think that would have gone a long way toward allowing for this cause to be settled as a case, because having the companies take part in the cleanup through the, you know, agreeing to it as part of this process would have gone a long way towards allowing, you know, a discussion, I think, that would have allowed for the parties to settle. Settle the case. So that was, you know, unfortunately we were not wise enough or experienced enough, I think, to understand that as much as I understand that now, and so that was a missed opportunity.
I guess I'd like to direct that question to the plaintiffs themselves. Would they have settled this case or given the instructions to settle this case if your lawyers had gotten some kind of cleanup and only a small amount of money for you early in the case?
It was certainly a better possibility. That was important to us, that things be rectified in our town.
And I sense both Donna and Mary are agreeing with that.
Yeah. Lauren McLean. One of the tragedies, I think, from the trial was that the plaintiffs directly lost their voice by the way the trial was set up. And I think one of the difficulties of this panel is that they have again lost their voice in terms of the discussions that have taken place among counsel, and we've heard a great deal about the impressions of the legal system and the process from those who were directly involved as counsel, but yet, if you watch body language, there were many opportunities when I noticed Dan and Donna and Mary were ready to say something, and I would be very interested in their reaction to what they heard today about the process that went on around them, which they were an important part of, but never had their voice in it.
Thank you, Lauren. It's my understanding that a trial is a process to seek the truth. And if there is a cause behind that process, what's wrong with that? And if there's passion with the cause, that's good. And when I hear last night on the film, Jerome Fasher say that the truth was told. Indeed, it wasn't. Some of the truth was told. It wasn't all told. And that's the pity of what happened in this trial. And that happens too often in trials. The truth is not allowed to be entered. And that's not right. And that's not the way the system ought to work.
Mary?
Yeah, I agree. It wasn't, we never got to tell our stories, and the stories were how our children suffered and, you know, what we went through, and not only with our children, but all the tests that we had to go through for the other side. They had us go to psychiatrists, and we had all kinds of buttons on our head and all kinds of blood tests and physicals to prove, I guess, so that we'd back down and back away. That's sad.
Donna?
Well, I have been sitting here feeling like that. Mm-hmm. There's a conversation between you and you, you know, and that the families are left out again. And you're talking about, you know, settlements, you know, discussing it with one another. And I think that even though I guess we're pretty naive to, you know, the legal system, you know, being families involved, you know, that went to a lawyer to try and handle this for us. The children have been forgotten in this, and that's not as it should have happened. This was all brought on because of the children, and we never got to speak for our children. I don't think that if, you know, it was brought up to us, no matter how many times, about making the settlement for money alone, we wouldn't have gone with it. It was more than that.
Well, Dan, this is part of the larger picture you talked about when we first started the panel. And the book and the movie have, in a sense, kept this story alive more than most stories of this kind ever experience. So what does tomorrow bring? Because quite clearly our plaintiffs still want the children remembered and the story of Woburn told. Does that leave it up to you journalists at this point?
I think the book is doing that because we're hearing from all across the country about cases and about children that are sick. And, you know, we can make it much more aware of the environment, what we're living in.
The book and movie have been really a positive influence. And what's happened that we're all sitting here today and discussing this is would have been a dead issue at this point had it gone no further than the trial. But through the book and through the movie, it's become alive again. The system and the way what happened to the children, what happened to the town, what happened with this case. And it's all been very positive. It's all brought it to the forefront, and people are talking about it again. The companies have been named again. And I think, you know, this is really our day to tell what happened and the importance of what happened and bringing that out.
Dan?
I think one of the reasons that the children have sometimes been overlooked in this, and I'm so glad that this panel has come to talking about this now, is that as you've heard the lawyers talking back and forth, it really does seem that a lawsuit is tried as if it were some sort of a sporting event, and Jerry Fasher was the best player on the field, and he sacked the plaintiff's lead witness, and that really had a lot to do with the outcome of the trial. But I think the kind of alternative dispute resolution that Jan is talking about now would tend to keep the